I think he's so silly. Here comes the Colonel.
Oh, well, welcome back to the second half hour of The Promise of Tomorrow. I'm your host, I'm Colonel Mason. This half hour, we're going to have a report directly from Australia, and we're going to check in with Pam Bailey on what the job picture looks like. Of course, at the end of the program, listener comments are the voice of reason, but right now, let's step over to our fountain of useless information we have here on the set to answer today's query.
Welcome to the fountain of useless information. How can I help?
Okay, oh spirit of the fountain, are you ready for this one? What industrialist regarded cows as inefficient and unsanitary, vowing in 1921, quote, the cow must go. The cow must go. What industrialist wanted to get rid of the cow?
I have given you my answer, and now you may tell me.
Okay, there's kind of a surprise here. The industrialist that wanted to get rid of cows? Henry Ford. Henry Ford wanted to get rid of the cows. I don't know what he wanted to do in place of them, you know, but that's it. And now on the subject of the drought conditions in Australia. The government deems it's climate change and is determined to put in what? A carbon tax or cap and trade? Well, we ask our old friend Michael Megalakis.
There's more questions than answers at the moment, but again, governments working on legislation to ensure that it operates. Now, whether it's effective or not, again, that's a separate topic. I'm not familiar with the details, so I can't really comment. But from a business point of view, talking to professionals at different levels in different industries, I don't think it would be fair to say that they don't really know how it's going to work. But that's okay. That's an education and awareness point of view as it starts rolling out.
But it appears from a business point of view that a lot of people stand to get very rich with carbon offsets and carbon trading and cap and trade. People that got their fingers in the industry without mentioning any names. So this is a whole shift of an entire shift of fortunes from one area to another, it appears.
Oh, yes. And again, that's been commented on over the last couple of weeks, last few weeks. Here in the media and talkback radio programs. So, again, it's going to be interesting to see how it all plays out. But bringing it down to actual industries and actual businesses, they're starting to get around on, okay, what do we need to do to start positioning ourselves strategically to further improve our environmental footprint performance in the context of energy consumption, water, consumption and waste, and being good corporate citizens. And again, we're sort of, I believe that there needs to be focus in that area, because at the end of the day, it's businesses that will need to look at the way they do things to remain competitive. The takeaway is quite obvious that there's a lot of opportunities associated with climate change, renewable technologies and so forth. Whether you're an engineer or a senior manager in a company or someone involved with industry, we're experiencing some exciting opportunities now. We're in it now, and there's opportunities to define how industries will behave or operate in a environment where climate change will need to be looked at seriously. So I see it as opportunity, development point of view, from an organisational development point of view, and also further improving environmental footprint on this planet called Earth. So exciting times. Again, look, at the end of the day, Colonel, it's good that, and hopefully what that'll do is stimulate discussion or debate through your program as well. There's a lot of noise out there, there's a lot of confusion, and hence my comment, there's a lot of opportunities because the strategies haven't been really defined. So there's great opportunities, as I've mentioned to you before.
Michael Megalakis speaking to us from Australia on the perceived climate change problems Australia is having with its drought conditions. And where are those R&D jobs that are going to solve all of our problems? Well, the person to ask, is, of course, Pam Bailey of Tiny Tech Jobs, an old friend of this program's, and we went right to her. So the jobs in this field will be engineers designing and producing and evaluating solutions to the problems.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And that goes across the whole field of computers and all sorts of electronics.
So those are mostly, I would classify the R&D people as mostly hardware. And, you know, there will also be jobs like computer specialists, computer scientists, programmers, software engineers who actually develop new technologies or programming languages or operating systems to work on the hardware that these other R&D people are developing.
Okay, and of course this means that somebody in this field could work for a startup company or for one of the giant corporations such as IBM, Intel, or HP, or any of them.
Sure, absolutely. HP's got one of the best nano research divisions, I guess you'd call it, or areas in the world, I think. You know, their quantum sciences group is really well respected.
Yeah, what a story they have, huh? Starting in their garage, and now they're HP. Whoa. Okay, informatics. Explain what informatics is and what positions might be available there, that sort of thing.
Well, I view informatics as the manipulation of data. You know, so when you're doing R&D, you generate, you know, tons and tons of data all the time, and you need to manipulate and analyze this data, and that's called informatics. In the biotech field, it's called bioinformatics because you're manipulating biological data. In the chemical field, it's called cheminformatics. I don't know if they have one called nanoinformatics yet or not, but, you know, essentially what nanotechnology eventually is going to do is give us unlimited computational power. So the ability to manipulate almost infinite amounts of data can really be important in modeling processes or modeling, say, what a molecule might look like in building unique structures. So it's going to be a very, very, very important part of everything.
Well, we certainly are going to need a wide range of people to working in these jobs, and I'm not sure where they're all going to come from, but I hope we start educating them. And also, you mentioned aerospace and automotive R&D kind of in the same breath when you do your talks. And the automotive industry right at the moment, of course, has kind of been taken over by the U.S. government, and they're kind of saying, look, you got to do smarter and build it better, and we're going to help you set it up so there's fueling stations around the country to help with this new technology and things like this. But why do you kind of link aerospace and automotive R&D together?
Oh, I just like the A's. No, I mean, you know, when I think about aerospace and automotive, how nanotechnology can impact on it, I think it's mostly, well, it's not. It's electronics. It's all different kinds of stuff. But I like to think about the materials that, you know, spacecraft as well as automobiles are constructed out of. Because nanotechnology is going to enable us to make materials that are lighter and stronger and cheaper and have all kinds of different properties that would be useful for both of these fields. I mean, in particular, in the automotive field, just eliminating the bulk of the weight of the vehicle would save so much energy. You know, and the same thing is true in aerospace. If you want to get those rockets out of the gravity field, you know, you have to use lots of rocket fuel. The lighter they are, the easier it's going to be for them to escape Earth's gravity. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does, but I always have a question with the reducing the weight in automobiles. I can see it in aerospace, but one thing we get with weight in automobiles is stability and safety. And, you know, you're driving along the road and something that works, you know, about the weight of paper, and a strong wind comes along, and pretty soon you're in the drink.
Well, I don't think that's going to happen, but again, the properties of these materials are going to be different. They may be lighter, but they'll be a lot stronger.
Strength, though, is one thing, but the stability in, say, a rainstorm or a windstorm, weight plays an important role. So I think that there's a limit to how much weight we can really reduce these vehicles.
Right. I see your point. It's a good point.
Okay, and you talked about research on improving individual components such as LED headlights and fuel injectors and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, again, the demand for more efficient vehicles that provide more power while using less fuel. And so, you know, a lot of that research is dedicated towards powertrain and car body R&D, like I just mentioned.
And nobody's going to give up personal transportation, so the automobile industry is going to be with us one way or another, and of course America is determined to stick with it, even though, you know, Britain lost theirs. There's not a single vehicle manufactured by a British-owned company anymore at all.
I'm sorry, what do you mean?
There is not a single automobile manufactured by a British-owned company. All their brands now, including Rolls-Royce and Jaguar and everything else, have all gone to companies that are outside of Britain.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, the last one was Rover, and it was sold, actually shut down, went bankrupt a few years ago, three or some years ago, and the Brits are very, very unhappy that they can't build an automobile.
So, you know, they no longer have an automobile industry.
They no longer have an automobile industry at all. The best they have is they build coaches for cabs, but they're using Japanese engineering in those cabs. And there's you can't buy a British car anymore.
Hmm.
But Ferrari's still doing well, and of course Fiat now is with Chrysler, and so, you know. And Germany, of course, is spectacular, and of course the Japanese and the Koreans are doing some sensational things, and now even China is doing well in cars, and America car industry is on its butt. So nanotechnology might just be the savior of that whole industry, at least for us.
Or we might be creating whole new industries, such as the solar industry, because I remember hearing somewhere that in Germany, I mean, car manufacturing in Germany has always been big, but solar manufacturing industry is approaching, you know, the top of where car manufacturing is.
Yeah, solar has got to be an immense future, except that I'm always reminded that we just cannot collect enough power from these new solar collectors that we need to do anything significant.
Well, I mean, they're working on ways to improve the conversion. I went to a thing that you mentioned earlier at IEEE yesterday where they talked about using nanowires and nanocrystals in these solar cells so that they could, you know, they have higher conversion rates. I think they have a lot of work to do, but I think eventually they'll come up with some good products.
Well, where they really need to come up with the products is in batteries, storing the energy once it's collected.
Hydrogen storage.
Yeah. Yeah.
That'd be great.
Yeah, well, Stan Olszewski has pioneered that, and I believe that that is certainly something that we can't ignore. That's you're right. Now, what about manufacturing? You know, a good friend of mine is head of the Chamber of Commerce in a little town that is a suburb of Dallas, Sunnyvale, and she they have no industry, and the tax base, of course, there is pretty high. She wants to bring in some industry and wants it to be clean industry, and is thinking about nanotechnology, and she's talking about manufacturing. What do you see as an answer for her?
Well, you know, it's really interesting because we can't really cover molecular manufacturing. It hasn't happened yet. It's beyond the scope of this interview, but we're definitely gonna need to produce nanomaterials or nanostructures or products that incorporate nanostructures or devices. And I'm seeing these manufacturing environments similar to biotech or semiconductor clean rooms.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know exactly what they're going to be manufacturing or how it's going to be done yet, but it's going to be very structured and as you mentioned, very clean. It's going to have to be done in highly filtered air so that none of these nanoparticles escape and contaminate the environment, what you were talking about before, toxicity. So production tasks might be carried out wearing a bunny suit in a clean room,
mm-hmm.
maybe even a cold room environment. So it'll be interesting to see how it turns out.
And special tasks performed under close supervision could include setup, operation, monitoring, that sort of thing.
Yeah, people would set up machines and equipment and operate them. They might label things and package things, and there'll be people who do process development, which will be optimization of processes and troubleshooting of production problems if a machine gets stuck, calibrating and adjusting and repairing equipment. Documentation is always a big deal in a manufacturing environment, documenting batch records, documenting exactly what you're doing and the quantities and quality of the materials, weighing and verification of raw materials, preparing media or buffers, and essentially helping with in-process testing and also quality control and quality assurance functions.
Well, these are the types of jobs that somebody wouldn't have to have intensive training to do. That an education, they could get trained specifically in how to do that specific job and work in the manufacturing the way people do right now without an intensive college education, I see, right?
Right, and there are a lot of two-year certificate-type programs springing up around the country, most notably in Pennsylvania. I think they're kind of leading that that sort of effort. So to train people for these sort of manufacturing, technician, quality control-type positions don't really require higher education or even a degree.
Okay.
Kind of where are the jobs? I mean, we discussed much of the R&D conducted by these companies, but where are they?
Well, a lot of R&D, you know, and that's a really broad field, is conducted by companies in a wide range of industries, as we talked about, pharmaceutical, chemical, transportation, aerospace. And those sorts of R&D functions can be found in a lot of places, but they're concentrated mostly in seven states. And those seven states are California, New York, Massachusetts, Illinois, Maryland, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey. But for nano and micro technology specifically, I don't know if you've ever read Small Times magazine, but they do a state ranking periodically mm-hmm. on nano and micro tech.
Mm-hmm.
And the last one that they did in 2007 ranked the states with Massachusetts at the top.
Mm-hmm.
And it was followed by Maryland, New Mexico, Connecticut, Colorado, Virginia, California, which is way down there and surprising to me, Washington, Rhode Island, and Delaware.
And they left Texas really near the bottom, I remember, but I remember so many people disagreed with that.
Right. You know, it's really interesting because in these surveys, they take into account a lot of the government facilities, the government fabs, the government foundries, the government labs. Those are big employers in nanotech.
Okay, and I noticed that you say over half the jobs in scientific R&D are in companies with more than 250 workers. Is that going to be the norm to expect?
I guess. Yeah, I would guess so. You need to have a fairly large company with a fairly large amount of money to conduct R&D. R&D is really expensive.
Yeah, okay. Jobs in university-based or government-funded non-fabrication foundries and that sort of thing, what do you say there?
Well, you know, I don't remember what the current budget is for the National Nanotechnology Initiative, but it's up there in the billion. I think it's $1.8 billion or something like that. That money is all filtering down through all the different government agencies and ending up in research, and they have these centers of excellence. They're trying to facilitate the flow of nanotechnology, you know, through the research process into commercial entities. And so what they're doing is they're making these foundries and these nanofabrication facilities that offer services to commercial entities. They'll help them develop their products. They'll help them produce them. And, you know, sort of trying to funnel that effort out so that we can begin to generate commercial products. Those are all being funded by the National Nanotechnology Initiative. And, you know, they're large employers.
Yeah, a lot of stuff is coming out of the universities because it's funded by the government, and I think that's some pretty interesting processes there. Also, Texas has the Emerging Technology Fund that funds a lot of these startups, too. Now, let's talk about education for just a minute. We've done a couple of programs here where we studied the new nano professor, which is a curriculum and an atomic force microscope and the software and everything else being produced by Nano Inc., and it allows kind of hands-on and that sort of thing. Do you see that we can mass train some people in education and get them into the nanotechnology industry to try to meet these demands for all these workers out there?
Yeah, I do think we can do that. And I also think a lot of people that are trained in electrical engineering or in mechanical engineering or chemical engineering can also participate since the quote-unquote industry is so interdisciplinary. I don't necessarily think a lot of people have to be retrained. What they need to have is a good, broad scientific education, you know, with some engineering and a lot of math and a lot of computer.
And I see you say that those with a bachelor's or higher degree held 72% of the jobs in the industry compared to only 30% in all industries. Now, can you explain that? What do you mean by that?
So, you know, if you look at industry, you know, a broad range of industries, only 30% of the people in those industries have bachelor's degrees, whereas if you sort of narrow it down and include those industries that might have nanotech, the people that that are employed, 72% of the people that are employed have bachelor's degrees, compared with 30% as a whole overall industry. So they have a much higher educational level in those fields.
Okay, and graduate degrees account, for 37% of the workers in scientific research and development, did you say?
Yeah, but only 10% overall. So it's really, you know, if I even look at tiny tech jobs, 74%, I think, of the people who have resumes in our database have graduate degrees, and those include PhDs and master's degrees, not just bachelor's degrees. So it's a much more highly educated population.
Okay, so how can science and engineering technicians enter the industry with a high school diploma?
Well, we talked about this before. There's a lot of two-year programs, certificate programs all over the place that are training people to meet these needs. So they train them as technicians. So they can do quality control, they can do manufacturing, they can, do lab tech type stuff. They don't need a degree to do that. So they could have a high school diploma, they could have some college or an associate's degree, but, you know, even some bachelor's degree holders begin as technicians and sort of get mentored under a scientist or an engineer to advance. Continuing on-the-job training is really important. They have to learn all the new equipment and methods.
Okay, Pam, and the National Science Foundation says that by 2015 we're going to need worldwide 2 million new workers in the fields of nanotechnology. Do you concur with that? Do you see that too?
Well, they've been saying that for 10 years already.
Yeah, but is it true?
I don't think it is. Do you?
What do you think is the number?
You know, I don't know. I don't know, Colonel. I don't know what the number is. I think that figure is misleading. 2 million. 2 million what? 2 million nanotechnology workers? We already decided that there aren't any such thing as nanotechnology workers. There are R&D workers in different fields in different industries. I don't know how they came up with that.
Okay, Pam Bailey, Tiny Tech Jobs, as always. Great to have you with us. And we'll look forward to the next time.
And now, we make time for the Voice of Reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
if we can invent something, if we can come up with a way to solve a problem at the component level, that's a great way to solve problems, a great way to spur invention and spur people into thinking creatively and productively in this economy. That's what we do, and that's what we try to teach our students to do is really to invent and to try to bring their ideas into the commercial marketplace and make an impact, one product at a time. Joe Meppelink, principal of MetaLab and assistant professor and director of applied research at the University of Houston, Gerald D. Hines College of Architecture.
So you decide, has this really been the Voice of Reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
You'll live tomorrow, 'cause you know it will be there. I am waiting. Oh.